from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vasily Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll learn about the comic opera The World on the Moon taking place at the Butler Arts Fest.
I'll find out what goes into making a Steinway piano sound like a Steinway.
And I'll get the update on the Indianapolis Library's strategic plan. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The World on the Moon is a short comic opera by Franz Joseph Haydn. It's billed as the first science fiction opera, so it's a perfect choice for Butler Music and Theater Departments to stage during the 2014 Butler Arts Fest, whose theme is fables, fairy tales, and physics. Sharon Gamble invited the production's music director, Tom Studebaker, and its stage director, William Fisher, to our studios to learn more about The World on the Moon and why it will be staged in Holcomb Observatory.
Where did this idea of doing a production of The World on the Moon come from? Were there other suggestions that might fit into this fables, fairy tales, and physics? Or did this just pop into somebody's head in the middle of the night? I'm looking from William to Tom to see.
I know where at least the idea came from, but I don't know if anything was discussed before I don't know if it was discussed, if other possibilities were discussed.
There weren't any really particularly that we had talked about. Ron just came to me one day and said, I have this really great idea for this Haydn opera. And he said, is this something we could do? It was originally written to be in an observatory. We had one on campus. And he said, can we do this? And I said, I don't know. And so he said, let's go over and take a look at the space. And I said, well, it's small, but I think we can. So we're making a go of it.
I've never heard music in the observatory, but I know the acoustics are good, kind of live.
They're going to be kind of, it'll be kind of loud, I think. with the dome in there for the planetarium,
yeah.
I think it's going to be very loud. But it's we have a much smaller, it's just a small contingent of players, just cello, violin, harpsichord, and oboe.
Okay. And this is an opera buffa, which
it is.
I'd like Tom to describe for us. What does that mean?
Well, it's it's just sort of a comedy. This one was originally, Haydn wrote it. It was originally premiered in 1777 for Count Nicholas Esterhazy's wedding celebrations. And then since then, it has sort of morphed into being a Singspiel. Called Die Welt auf dem Munde.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we aren't doing it in German or Italian, either one. But what we have done is we have incorporated the idea of a Singspiel by actually using dialogue versus recitative.
Mm-hmm.
And the recitatives, I think it will save us a little time. We wanted to cut this down a little bit because it's quite long.
Mm-hmm.
So in cutting it down, we thought we would save some time. And I discussed that with William to see what he thought about that. And he said, yes, I think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
That's...
Well, and from another perspective, the libretto and the story was written by Carlo Goldoni. Carlo Goldoni was sort of the most important writer of Italian comedy of the mid
18th century.
His best known play is A Servant of Two Masters, but it is this style of writing and the story itself, though not directly attributable, is it kind of in the style or tradition of commedia dell'arte.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the characters are not all exactly the stock characters of the commedia are of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of story it is.
So for somebody who's not terribly familiar, can you expand on that a little bit? tell us what kind of characters we might encounter?
Well, the Commedia dell'arte was and is still, because it's still practiced, a form of mostly improvisational theater based on stock characters and stock scenarios. And so some of the characters that are best known, of course, as the Arlecchino, that in France was the Harlequin, all of the characters that you would think of in what is referred to as the British pantomime, which is not a pantomime of another tradition, but is the pantomime of the this kind of Italian comedy stories with stock characters and stock situations and very physically or physical, lots of physical comedy, lots of body and highly, I suppose you could say stylized, but really a very sort of popular theater, especially in which the characters who are servants and who are the more popular characters are always A, more clever, and B, wiser and more have more fun than the aristocratic or older characters who are always somehow duped and always sort of led by their own negative appetites or negative ambitions towards other people. So this is certainly the case in the story of The World on the Moon.
So what is the story? And are we observing the world from the moon, or set us up here?
Well, basically, it's the story of a father who wants to control his daughter and daughters. He is duped by a, I'm making quotes in the air, scientist, who convinces him that he can drink a potion and be transported to the moon. And the father, who is never, the father is then duped into both giving up his daughter and her dowry to this gentleman, in addition to giving up his other daughter to another fellow who is one of her suitors.
Well, so, and his maid as well, actually,
and the maid to the servant of the scientist, the so-called scientist.
So this is a really interesting choice of subject matter to commission for a wedding. Do we know how much input Prince Esterhazy had into the content of this?
Hard to say. I've never read anything that stated how much he had, but assuming, I mean, knowing that the Esterhazys were actually Haydn's patrons, I can assume that Haydn would have done everything he could to not insult them.
I would say that in the tradition of the Commedia dell'arte and even of the writers who come out of it, particularly Goldoni and in France, Molière, I would say that they were trying as hard as they could to insult him, but without him actually realizing it or without him paying attention.
Sure, probably.
And that's complete speculation. But
it's a little excuse me. Underground politicizing there. Yeah.
Well, if you think about other plays, Servant of Two Masters is certainly, in terms of Goldoni's plays, certainly it does not portray the ruling classes very favorably.
So it's a way to make those of us poor working folk feel a little bit better about our station in life.
I would say so.
Again, like you said, not the least of which were things like that Mozart wrote, when you consider consider La Nozze di Figaro and things like that, which were that same idea with the Count being the one who's duped in the end and all of that. It's that same kind of thing.
Hey, if we like Haydn, if somebody's listening saying, I like Haydn symphonies, I like Haydn string quartets, would we like the music in this work?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The thing about Haydn's operas, and really opera in general, it's very different now than it was back then, because particularly in Handel's time, people would go to the opera. But when they went to the opera, they were sitting at a dinner table eating their dinner and talking to their friends. And when their favorite singer came out on stage, they stopped talking, listened to their favorite singer. When their favorite singer was finished, then they would leave. they'd leave stage, and the people would go back to talking and eating and all that while the other singers sang. The idea of the lights coming down in the theater didn't really come until mid to late 1800s.
So that's pretty recent.
I think
recent.
Cosima Wagner had a lot to do with that. Oh. And we can only assume that this is the same kind of thing that's happening In Haydn's time.
Not that you're encouraging the audience that comes out to see this production to be chatting with their neighbors.
Go have dinner first and then come listen to us.
I don't think there's going to be any possibility of chatting given the acoustics of the
space. No kidding. Indeed. So let's talk about this space. I mean, you're both accustomed to working in more traditional spaces where there's fly space, where there's wing space. And how do you have that in the observatory?
Well, we're basically removing half the seats.
Okay.
And if you know the observatory, and by the way, I think part of Ron, the dean's idea of this came from a production in a large observatory recently in New York City, in the Haydn Observatory in the Natural History Museum,
which
is massive.
Yeah, right.
As Holcomb Observatory is not massive.
Right.
So what we are doing, however, is taking half the seats out and building a stage. And we're building a stage at the level where there's a little area around the star ball, which is what it's called. And so at that level, we're building a stage across just about half of the space. So there will only be audience on one side, and then singers, star ball, musicians kind of back in the corner. And I was really, really pleased that it works out that the harpsichordist is basically going to be the conductor.
The conductor, yes.
So we don't need another person conduct another person because we don't have room for them.
Right, right. So intimate. So
and the control panel, the control booth actually for lights and for the star ball and for our video projection onto half of the dome. We hope is how we're trying to make this work out. They will be behind the playing area, behind the stage, and they will be in full view actually the whole time.
Oh, that's kind of fun too.
So that'll be fun. And the musicians, of course, will be kind of tucked away, but they won't be completely invisible.
So how are you preparing your singers and actors? I mean, because they're doing both, many of whom have maybe been on stage in Schrott Hall, maybe some of them even Clues Hall. Are they scared of being so close to their audience?
No, I don't think so. We've done some things in similar spaces, small spaces like that. I don't mean to say similar necessarily.
But Ides and Duckwall maybe, which is more intimate?
Yes, certainly there, and even the Black Box Theater on the third floor of Lilly Hall.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Where you really literally are on top of your audience. Mm-hmm. And so they're not so afraid of that. I think we haven't had the chance to sing in the observatory yet. But I think our main concern there is really has more to do with are we going to have to pull back vocally to do that? And because I told them, I said, as loud as this is in our rehearsal space, it's going to be 3 or 4 times louder there. So we may end up finding we have to pull back just a little bit. And that's a little scary vocally, but I don't think it's something that can't be done.
Sure. I should tell our listeners, we're having this conversation several weeks before the performances. So do you get how many rehearsals do you get in the observatory?
We'll be in the week before, basically.
Oh, good.
The week leading in, but these will be spacing rehearsals mostly, going into technical rehearsals.
Right.
We'll have everything worked out, and we're just about, in fact, as at this date, we are making the handoff in a way where I'm actually entering the process. They've learned the music. They've been working on it for the semester already. And starting next week, I'm coming in. And once we close our production that I've directed at in the theater department, which it's too late to promote here, but which was great.
We all enjoyed that very much.
Then I'll be coming in. excuse me. I'll be coming in starting next week to get everything on its feet to direct the opera, as it were.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question is how does this partnership work? Do you have to be given that, Tom, you're coming to this from the musical text and, William, you're coming from the words and the emotion. You're both coming to it from an emotional inspiration, motivation viewpoint. Did you have to try to get on the same page, or will that be worked out as you, William, get further into the rehearsals?
One of the things that's interesting to me about this, among many others, the material itself, working with Tom and working with singers, is that my preference in directing is to work in some very structural way, no matter what. And music is the ultimate structured art form mm-hmm. in a certain way. So it's really reassuring to know, we were talking about it on the way here, that right now we're coming in at about an hour and 11 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's something for me to work with.
Right.
We have limited space that I can work with. We have a certain number of people. And we will start looking at the words next week, separate from the music. But the music not only can't, but shouldn't and won't change. Perhaps some of what's inside of it will continue to develop. And with the amount of space restriction of radio, the audience area is probably about the size of this studio.
Which is about, 14 feet square, give or take?
Yeah, I would say.
And that's just big.
A guesstimate.
Yeah.
And then the stage, the rest of the space is about the same amount, the same size.
Wow.
So working within those limitations and working structurally is really the way I prefer to work anyway. So for me, it's very exciting. There are also severe limitations and I work in space as well, so spatially, actually, even more so than emotionally,
mm-hmm.
From my perspective. Well, the space is also extremely limited, so how that gets used and how the relationship between the bodies, the singing people and their bodies on stage, is the big challenge.
Sharon Gamble with Butler University faculty members William Fisher and Tom Studebaker. Though it was written by Haydn during the 18th century, this production of The World on the Moon features stylish 1950s costumes by Butler's Wendy Meaden. It's part of Butler's 2014 Arts Fest, with performances in early April. Seating is limited to 40 people, because it is at Holcomb Observatory. Find out about tickets for all shows, including a benefit performance and a late-night performance, at butlerartsfest.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Recently, Craig Gygax of Meridian Music went to the Steinway Factory in New York City to help pick out a piano for the Grand Hall at the Indiana Landmark Center. Travis DiNicola spoke with Gygax about what goes into making a Steinway, and how he goes about auditioning the instruments.
Craig, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thanks, Travis. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
Now, I know, of course, with your role with Meridian Music, you see lots of Steinways, but this one is a pretty special one, we're going to be talking about, and you actually got to go to New York and help pick this out. Tell me about sort of how this whole thing came about, your partnership with working with Landmarks and picking out this piano.
Okay, sure. Well, of course, as you know, Indiana Landmarks is a terrific new concert venue in Indianapolis. It's an old church built mm-hmm. in 1891, and Indiana Landmarks restored it with the financial support of Bill Cook, and so the finished product was this gorgeous, acoustically beautiful mm-hmm. Auditorium, the former sanctuary,
is now known as the Grand Hall.
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm.
And that Grand Hall called for a piano mm-hmm. for a concert grand. And so over time, through a series of conversations that I had with Marsh Davis and with Sharon Gamble at mm-hmm. Indiana Landmarks, the Alan Whitehill Clues Foundation
right.
Generously donated a sufficient amount of money that Indiana Landmarks was able to purchase a piano for.
And this was
the recital hall.
Pretty big deal for them, because up until that point, different organizations that were using it had to rent a piano, bring one in, things like that.
Right.
So to have a really high quality permanent one.
Absolutely.
Quite important.
And in fact, on several occasions, we brought our Steinway concert grand in to have it used, and my delivery guys would have to push it up the steps and take it back down the steps. And, you know, it's 900 pounds.
Yeah.
But with this gift, to be able to select a piano specifically for that space
mm-hmm.
was really important. Now there's a piano that is tuned and voiced for that that space and selected specifically for the Grand Hall.
That's great. Mm-hmm. So you and Marsh got to go off to New York and actually go to the Steinway factory and pick this specific Model D Concert Grand out.
We did. It's always a thrill to be able to go there. I've done this mm-hmm. a number of different times.
Okay.
And what's so wonderful about Steinways is that because they're handmade mm-hmm. and by any number of different artisans, each piano has its own characteristics. It has its own personality, its own voice.
Okay.
And so we went into an acoustically perfect room mm-hmm. With Spencer Meyer, who had been the American Pianist Association's 2006 DeHaan Fellow.
Sure.
APA is based here in Indianapolis, and the competition was here in Indianapolis. And Spencer, along with Marsh and with Joel Harrison of the American Pianist Association, mm-hmm. played through six different concert grands and one by one eliminated the pianos until we finally found the piano that had just the perfect voice.
Now how do you go about doing that? Because, I mean, I'm assuming that, I mean, all of these Steinways, these six, were all incredible instruments. And so none of them were, like, faulty or anything. But you're just looking for a different type of special sound or feel or...
Right. Now, some pianos mm-hmm. Will not be as powerful as others. So if you're selecting a piano for a teaching studio, say, at Ball State or at Indiana University, mm-hmm. you're not going to want a piano that has a big, powerful voice. It would just simply overpower the room.
Mm-hmm.
You might be looking for a piano for a small concert space. And again, a big piano would overpower a small space. And conversely, if you were to buy a piano with a small voice, mm-hmm. it wouldn't fill a space
sure.
as large as the Grand
so
Hall.
So it's really sort of the size of the voice and the quality and things right. that they were sort of more drawn to.
And then other things like just subtleties,
yeah.
the overtones. You'll hear the different strings, the harmonics from the different strings speaking to each other. And
mm-hmm.
and when a chord is struck, some pianos, the sound just continues to grow
mm-hmm.
instead of decaying right away. And so those were what we were looking for, a piano where the sound just blossomed
mm-hmm.
and where it sustained really well. So, again, to fill that big hall.
Sure. Now, I got to ask you, because now this is radio, but you brought along some visual aids. You brought along a whole bunch of crayons, which I'm not quite sure what you're going to do with here. But you did say that this is going to help me understand sort of what makes a Steinway a Steinway.
That's right. Okay, so what you see here, these are off-brand
mm-hmm.
crayons.
Sort of
small
generic
box,
crayons.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
small box. Okay, so pianos are kind of like these crayons in mm-hmm. that every piano is built with basically the same materials. You know, it's wood
mm-hmm.
and it's steel and it's cast iron. And those are really the components.
Okay.
But what differentiates them is the quality of the materials and
mm-hmm.
the quality of the workmanship. So here we have our basic generic, and certainly they'll work, right? I mean,
right.
you can sit down and color.
It looks like, what, a box of 18 there or something?
A box of 16.
16. Mm-hmm.
So then I can get a box of 16 of the premium brand, which I think
some very nice Crayolas there, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You would agree that you could paint a prettier picture.
Sure.
Even though you have the same 16 colors because of the quality of the workmanship here, the materials. So what you have is basically your cheap, poorly built piano here, and one that uses some better materials, but still has limitations in the number of colors.
Only 16.
Right. And then when you start getting into better pianos, you get more colors.
A box
still
of 24.
Better quality.
Mm-hmm.
Still better, 64.
Yep.
But when you get to a Steinway,
mm-hmm.
the quality is the same in the box of 64 as it is in the box of 120. But with 120 colors.
That's a lot of colors.
You can produce a much more beautiful
mm-hmm.
product. And that's the way Steinway is. Every man.
But to be clear, it's still the same number of strings and keys, right?
Still the same number of, for the most part, it's the same number of strings and keys. There's one manufacturer that has some extra keys.
Okay.
But for the most part, that's true. But what differentiates a Steinway from all of the others,
mm-hmm.
again, the good manufacturers, the better manufacturers all use the same kinds of materials,
mm-hmm.
but because of the design and because of the workmanship, the result is pretty much a perfect instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And in this day and age where we live, when the Dallas Cowboys signed contracts with Nike to supply equipment for $120 million a year and, you know, paid endorsements.
Sure.
Steinway pays no one to play the pianos, and yet...
Almost everyone chooses that.
Overwhelmingly, Steinway is chosen because of this color palette. It is the best product with which an artist can express himself or herself.
That must be a very fun experience for you, going out to that factory. As you said, you've had a chance to do it a number of times, but picking out the specific instruments. I mean, certainly your role with Meridian Music, you get to do that.
Not often enough.
And let me ask you about Meridian Music, because you guys have been doing some interesting things. I mean, you've got a gorgeous space up on Meridian Street up in Carmel, and I know you've been doing some concerts up there. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean, because that's a pretty neat thing for you guys to do as well.
Well, thank you. If I could just briefly touch upon the history, there's a connection. My father founded Meridian Music in 1988, and prior to that time, he had been the vice president of sales and marketing for Steinway. And so
there's the family connection.
We've been connected to Steinway since my father went to work for them in 1962.
Wow.
And so I never tire of walking into the company and into the Steinway factory. And it's always a pleasure to be able to be affiliated with Steinway, with the premier piano manufacturer in the world. Meridian Music, again, as I mentioned, was founded in 1988, and we were founded at 96th and Meridian at that time, and now we're in Carmel on Old Meridian Street.
Yep, a little bit farther up there, but... Mm-hmm.
We have a recital hall that seats 120, and so in that recital hall, there are master classes held, there are recitals, there are... we have a large education program with about 1,200 students and roughly 45 teachers that teach for us, and our own teachers use... that space, but also outside teachers and outside groups use our space as well.
Sure.
And so we have the opportunity to have lots and lots of people parade through our doors every year. And the great thing is that sitting on the stage is a Steinway grand piano, not unlike the one that people will see on the stage in the Grand Hall at Indiana Landmarks.
Excellent. Hey, let me ask you, going back to that one that people are going to see at the Grand Hall, because it is going to have its debut coming up on March 23rd. And you had mentioned Spencer Meyer, who helped to pick it out, and he'll be playing it that afternoon as part of the concert. How would you describe the piano that was picked out for the Grand Hall? I mean, in terms of its sound, I mean, I know that it's a Model D Concert Grand, but in terms of, I mean, just how would you describe the sound or the look of it also?
Well, it's first of all, historically, Steinway pianos have been a satin ebony finish. It's sort of
sort of the standard what you expect always with that, yeah.
But recently, Steinway was able to get EPA certification, the New York EPA, that allowed them to begin to produce polyester finished pianos. And polyester is problematic. In Asia, virtually every manufacturer produces pianos in polyester. They don't have to worry about air pollution.
Okay.
But in New York, we did have to. And so Steinway was finally able to get certification and capture the pollution, but they're still able to now produce the pianos in a polyester, which is really shiny, and it's a really hard finish. This piano in the Grand Hall is the first of the polyester finished pianos to come to Indiana.
Wow.
And is now
That's
on the stage.
Cool.
So it's very distinctive, and it just glistens. It shines. And, of course, when you lift the lid, the reflection of the strings on the bottom of the lid.
Like a mirror.
It's gorgeous. So that's the physical appearance of the piano. Again, it's 9 feet long. But the tone color, I mentioned earlier, you want to make sure that you get a piano that's suitable for the space. The piano that was chosen for the Circle Theater had to be a big concerto instrument so that it can carry over the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra.
Of course.
This piano will be principally a solo instrument or a chamber instrument. So what you have with this instrument is a piano, again, that when you strike it, the sound blooms and it grows. It's not an overpowering piano, but it's very rich and very even all across the range of sound, all the way from the bottom sound in the bass to the top sound in the treble.
Interesting. So very much, it sounds like a pianist piano.
It's a pianist piano,
and as
right.
you said, you know, perfect for solo and for that space.
Right.
That's great. Certainly a great addition to Indiana Landmarks and their Grand Hall to be able to have this. And again, what a great experience it must have been for you.
It was wonderful. There's nothing at all like I never tire of walking through those doors at the Steinway factory to see them building pianos in virtually the same way that they've built them for more than 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear a fantastic pianist like Spencer Meyer sit down and work through the different instruments and work them through the range, through a dynamic range, to finally select the perfect piano. It was wonderful.
Excellent. Greg, thanks so much for coming in Art of the Matter. Great to see you again.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Craig Gygax of Meridian Music. You can hear the new Steinway Model D Concert Grand Piano when it debuts on Sunday, March 23rd with an APA 2006 DeHaan Classical Fellow Spencer Meyer, who helped choose the piano, performing music that showcases the versatility of the instrument and of the pianist. The performance begins at 3 p.m. with a brief reception following. There's also a 2 p.m. patron pre-concert champagne celebration at the Grand Hall, Indiana Landmark Center. You can get information about tickets to both of those things at indianalandmarks.org, indianalandmarks.org.
What do you think, Sharon?
Well, it's a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer movie. It's the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you're indicating that March has come in like a lion?
At least you thought it sounded like a lion. That's good.
No, well, lion, I definitely got the lion.
Okay,
part.
Well, good. Yeah. Well, you know, we'll get to the lambs later on in this month,
that's
right?
That's right. But meanwhile, we have some things to take your mind off the lionly weather.
On that calendar we call,
What do we do?
So true. Hey, this sounds really fun. This is a festival going on at the Phoenix Theater, the Basile 1 Minute Play Festival. Three performances only. Starts on March 22nd and then 23rd and 24th at the Phoenix Theater, of course. Works by Lou Harry, as well as Jim Poyser, Ken Weitzman, and playwright in residence Tom Horan. And yep, it's a 1 Minute Play Festival. That's exactly what it is. Well, 51 minute plays that have been written. In fact, by 25 different authors for this event. It sounds like just a ton of fun, and it's also part of sort of a national type of event as well. You can get more information, of course, at Phoenix Theater, 1 Minute Plays.
You can say a lot in a minute, I'm just saying.
You know what? For as long as it took me to describe it, you could have had a whole play right there.
That's right. There we go. Hey, this weekend the ISO continues its all one cultural background concerts. Last weekend it was
longer than a minute, though.
Well, longer than a minute. Last weekend it was a concert with a series of Polish works. This weekend it's Russian works by Mussorgsky, Rachmaninoff, and Stravinsky, including the Suite from the Firebird, the 1945 revision, if you know your music. Concerts, if you're hearing us on Friday night, you can still go tomorrow night at 8. If you're hearing us on Saturday morning, you can go tonight at 8. Get online and grab yourself some tickets.
Some really cool concerts coming up at the Palladium up in Carmel, including the Pat Metheny Group. They're going to be playing on March 14th at 8 o'clock. Great, great jazz guitar. Grammy Award winner and just fantastic performer. And he'll be there on the 14th. And then also on the 14th in the Tarkington Theater, and then again on the 15th, the Koresh Dance Company, which is out of Philadelphia. Really sort of high energy, kind of a mix of ballet and modern and jazz, but super physical, super high energy, and they're going to be doing an interpretation of Bolero, which should be a lot of fun.
Mm.
Cool things coming up at the Palladium.
Fun. Hey, the Artemis String Quartet is coming to town on Wednesday, March 19th. For a concert that includes not one but two Brahms string quartets, the quartet in B-flat major, opus 67, and the quartet in C minor, opus 51, number 1. As well on the program, a work by Yorgi Kurtag. It's the opus 28 quartet.
and this is taking place at the Basile Theater at the Glick Indiana History Center. It's on Wednesday, March 19th, pre-concert conversation at 6:45, and then the concert following. More information at ensemblemusic.org. The concert's at 7:30 if you want to just show up in time for the concert. So ensemblemusic.org. Tickets should be available at the door as well.
Sharon, I was not born yesterday.
What?
What? But
I'm shocked. You're so
but
young.
If you wanted to see the play Born Yesterday, which happens to be directed by our own Matt Soucy, it's taking place at the Scottish Rite Performing Arts Center on Meridian Street. And, in fact, it is just opening now, March 7th through the 15th. And there's a matinee on the 15th otherwise. Weekend performances at 7:30 p.m. And you can get tickets and get more information if you call 262-3100. It is a funny, funny comedy, Born Yesterday.
Love it. Now, there's an author's breakfast coming up on Saturday, April 12th.
Because authors have to eat, too.
Because authors have to eat. They deserve to eat. They deserve bagels and cream cheese and maybe some eggs for some protein. I'm just saying. The Dyslexia Institute of Indiana is sponsoring its fifth annual Indiana Authors Breakfast. It's Saturday, April 12th at the Meridian Hills Country Club. It's at 8:30 because we don't want to prod authors out of bed too awfully early. But before the actual serving of breakfast, you can mingle and meet the authors and have a chance to purchase their books and get your copies autographed, of course. Each author will have an opportunity to talk briefly about his or her book and his or her writing experiences. The authors include Berkeley Duck, The Grapevine, Michael Daly, who's going to talk about The Best of Youth, his recent novel, Allison Lynn, The Exiles, you heard about both those novels recently, Peter Dunn, Avoid Student Loan, Stephen Stein, The Shaker Experience in America, Doug Wissing, Crown Hill, History and Spirit and Sanctuary. And you can learn more by dialing 317-222-6635, 317-222-6635. Worthy cause.
Absolutely. Sharon, that is all the time we have this week, so we'll have to come back next week for that calendar we call.
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The Indianapolis Public Library has been working on its new strategic plan for the last year, with town hall meetings and lots of chances for public input. Sharon Gamble invited Library CEO Jackie Needis to our studios for a sneak preview.
So there was a time not super long ago when if I said library to 8 of 10 people that I met on the street, they'd say books. And while people still think books, the library is so, so much more.
It absolutely is. In fact, it's getting to be fun because there are so many diverse things in our collection now that if you want to still read books in paper, you can, or you can read books in a downloadable audio that you listen to on the treadmill, or you can read your books in a downloadable e-book that you can sit in the sun with and not have any glare. It's amazing.
And if your ebook doesn't fit that description, you need to go to find out one of the Tinker Stations and play with the different ebooks.
Absolutely. They'll let you tinker around with them until you find one that feels right in your hands.
Yeah, love that. So the library strategic plan, this process has been going on for how long?
The kickoff meeting was actually last summer, last July, so we're well into this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the plans tend to be 5 years, 5-year plans?
It is a 5-year plan. We're in the last year of a plan that Dr. Martin Jiske helped the library with the last time out, and so that'll finish up at the end of 2014. The new plan will go back to the steering committee later in March for some more discussion and review, and they will present a proposed or recommended plan to the library board in April.
Wow, that's pretty fast. I went to that initial meeting last summer. That was fun.
Post-it notes all over the place. Lots of debate going on. It was a very, very high energy meeting. We were thrilled to have that kind of input from across the community.
Yeah. So there are four overarching goals.
There are. It came out of the work of 9 different task forces, but at the end distilled down to 4 goals that we think capture a good direction for the next few years.
And can we talk just a little bit about each one? The first one, enrich Indianapolis's desire for personal growth and learning.
Mm-hmm. 3 of the task forces produced work that fed into this goal. One was about strengthening the library's contribution to formal education. Without a doubt, the library is an important partner to all of our formal education efforts, whether they be early childhood, elementary, high school, or higher education. There are places for the library to be supportive, and we have a number of strategies there. Also, informal education is really becoming more and more important to people, whether it be retraining for jobs or retirees who want to keep their minds sharp and want to keep learning. And the informal education system seems to be getting richer every year, and there's a lot of places for the library to plug into that. And then, of course, as I mentioned, helping residents prepare for successful employment. Lots of personal growth and learning moments there that the library can be part of. So that one's really exciting and says a lot about how our city has to get stronger if we're going to be a great city.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Goal 2, strengthen Indianapolis neighborhoods and businesses.
I suppose this one's a little close to my heart, given all of my neighborhood work over the years, but I've always viewed the library as an important resource center or civic gathering space for any of our neighborhoods. And there's much more that we can do in that regard in terms of whether it's a meeting space, whether it's an information center for different groups of people. Certainly welcoming our immigrant population and helping them become more integrated into our neighborhoods is a very important task that lies ahead of us. And Lord knows all of our neighborhoods need to be healthier, whether it's community gardens or whether it's the garden on the go truck stopping to make sure there's healthy food in a neighborhood, or whether it's providing free internet access. For many of our neighborhoods, for many of our families, the library is the place you find that. And so I think all of those strategies will be part of that goal.
It's kind of like the library is the new town square for a lot of folks.
That's a great way to visualize it. And that town square is both physical and virtual, but mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah. Goal 3, act as agents of innovation in the Indianapolis community. How is that a library role?
Well, you know, if you want to learn something, if you really want to be innovative, you've got to be keeping up with new developments. You've got to be learning about the new technologies, or at least trying to understand what does it mean when that guy from Facebook goes out and buys this wonderful app, and that's somehow or another going to allow him to take over the entire world.
Right.
It's like, how do I find out about that? Well, actually, your library can be part of that. But sometimes it's demonstrations of things. We've had 3D printers, for example, and just the whole Tinker Station idea, the notion of how do I keep up with new technology? And libraries nowadays are starting to be much more of a laboratory for people to experiment with things. We're seeing libraries that are demonstrating Google Glasses or demonstrating some of the new scanning technology so that people can capture their family histories better. So a lot of ways to showcase and organize new ideas, whether it be through speakers or hands-on activities. I'm reminded of the robotics competition that we held at Central Library about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in there that day and I felt like I was in a hotbed of creativity.
Mm.
The youngsters and their coaches were all over the building and they were all exploring new dimensions.
Mm.
And I think that's something the library can be a center for across our community.
Sure. And then the fourth goal, maximize accessibility to the library and its services.
This is a complex one, but without it, the other three don't go anywhere. Because if we do all that wonderful stuff and you can't get access to it, then it might as well not be there.
Sure. Right?
The tree falls in the forest. Is anybody here?
Right.
And so when we talk about accessibility, we're talking about a range of concerns. It can be as simple as the fact that the East Washington Library, which serves a very, very young and a very elderly community,
mm-hmm.
does not have an elevator, and you can't get...
That's one of the old Carnegie libraries.
Is.
Yeah.
It's a treasure in our community, 102 years old, but you can't get up there.
Right.
So
you can't even get in the front door because there's steps up to the front door.
You can't get in the front
yeah.
door. So, so accessibility might be that simple. Accessibility also might mean, is there a library in your community at all? We're fortunate here in the center part of the city to have a lot of libraries, but as you look out into the townships, there really are large areas with very limited access to a public library. And we're trying to take a look at that and understand how we can realign our services to meet some of those needs. We're also making the library more accessible by partnering with a lot of our schools. 27 schools across the city have joined our shared system, and their students have immediate access through the catalog to our 1.2 million items in our collection.
Is this an interlibrary loan system then?
It is actually even more intense than that. They get on the catalog in their school library. They see what we own. They see what the other 27 schools own. And then there's a delivery service that brings it to them at their school.
Whoa.
Or they can ask to have it held at a branch library that's on their way home. Either way, but the point is they have much greater access. You know, immediately they know, what does the library have?
Right.
And it's really increasing the readership at many of these schools.
So let's go back for a minute because, you know, as you say, the center of the city is pretty well served because at the time when a lot of bricks and mortar libraries were being built, that's where the population was. Population has shifted rather dramatically. And there are
23
sites total?
23 branches. And originally, the public library was a department of the IPS schools. So that's another reason that you see such a concentration of library locations within the old IPS district. But back in 1965 or so, when we became a countywide system, we did make an effort to try to get out into the townships, but we really haven't kept up with the population trends.
Sure.
And if you think about how many people have moved from Center Township out to 42nd and Post Road, for example,
mm-hmm.
you know, huge migration out that way. We have not followed very well with library services out there. Same thing going up Michigan Road. Pike Township has been transformed over the years, and we only have one library in Pike Township. Mm. Down in Perry Township, it's especially concerning to us because in Perry Township, we only have the Southport Library, and yet there's been very significant population development down there. And we've got to find a way to catch up with those folks
mm-hmm.
and get some library service that's more accessible for them.
And it's tough in an era when people are thinking, oh, library, how old school. Let's not spend a lot of money because everything's on the internet. There's this kind of flip attitude. Everything's on the internet.
Yeah, and there's two problems with that.
Why should we go out to a library?
Okay. Well, but that's absolutely what people say. And in fact, the reality is the exact opposite. Because first of all, there is so much on the internet, and most people struggle to find their way through it. They need a coach or a guide through that forest of stuff. But the other more serious concern, frankly, is that 40% of our homes still don't have high-speed access to the internet.
Wow.
And so there's plenty of folks all across our county who are not able to access the internet to order their prescriptions or to get a medical report from their doctor or to file some kind of a claim with the state of Indiana, all of these different governmental services that are now done online, if you don't have an internet at home, or if you're elderly and are uncomfortable using it by yourself, where are you going to go?
Right.
You know, the library is where these people come to day in and day out.
There's always a line for the computer. We were talking before we turned on the computer. My home libraries are Central and Glendale, because that's where I am a lot of the time. And there is never a free computer terminal. And that's great. I mean, it's terrific because the people are taking great advantage.
We track the use of all of our computers. And whenever the usage gets up above a certain percentage, we will actually rearrange and try to bring in a few more computers
so
that we can try to keep the traffic at a tolerable level, because there's too much demand.
And by the way, that was a compliment, not a complaint, in case people are wondering.
We're always watchful of that, and we try to maximize people's time on the computers. In a few instances, we've been able to increase the amount of time you can stay on a computer because the wait times are getting a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are coming into the library now with their own device.
Mm-hmm.
They have a smartphone or they have a laptop. They just don't have internet at home. And we're now running about 8,000 times a week that somebody comes into the library with their device and uses our internet. It's kind of an interesting development.
That's stunning.
But, you know, there is a secondhand market for laptops now, so they're a little more affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people have smartphones. They just don't want to use up all their minutes on the internet. And so if they can come to the library and use our signal, they can get access to things.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Public Library CEO Jackie Needus. You can learn more about the library's new strategic plan at imcpl.org. Again, imcpl.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of the James Spencer Russell art exhibit at the Indiana State Museum.
I'll get the big picture view of the upcoming Butler Arts Fest.
And then I'll find out how some local artists are bringing a little bit of Brazil to Indianapolis this spring. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.